The U.S. Israeli genocide in Gaza continues with the 165th day, with the death toll surpassing 31,700, mostly women and children. France's UN envoy says the Gaza situation is absolutely catastrophic, urging the international body to overcome its inaction and declare an immediate ceasefire. And Israeli occupation forces carry out night raids on several areas of the West Bank, abducting at least two young Palestinians. It's good to have you with us. More civilians lose their lives in Gaza as the Israeli regime presses ahead with its genocidal military campaign across the besieged Palestinian territory. The regime warplanes struck several houses in various locations in Rafah Governorate, killing at least 14 Palestinians and injuring a number of others. In central Gaza, Israeli artillery shelled the vicinity of both Nuseirat and Bereij refugee camps. Several neighborhoods in Gaza City were bombed as well. Israel unleashed its genocide in Gaza in early October. Over 31,700 Palestinians have been killed so far, most of them women and children. The war rages on while Gazans are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid severe food shortages and other devastating impacts of relentless Israeli attacks. Muti Abu Musaba, a correspondent to the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah, says the humanitarian situation in the besieged strip is worsening with the passage of time.
So we are talking about continuous airstrikes. Those airstrikes actually are intensified until this moment, by the way, against the western part of Gaza City and even the center of Nuseirat refugee camp. And here, as you can see here in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, the people are began actually to gather in order to bid farewell to those Palestinian civilians who were killed over the last night, as usual. The Palestinian civilians are still being killed day and night by the Israeli continuous and relentless airstrikes and attacks, while the humanitarian conditions on the ground are still exacerbating with the time, as the Israeli policy is still constant in terms of stalling and procrastinating the entry of those humanitarian aid to the people. And they are, as we have mentioned, they are deliberately and systematically attacking those humanitarian aid and the people who are waiting for the humanitarian aid. The last crime was in Jabalia, and over the last couple of weeks, as you know, that the Palestinian civilians near Al-Kuwait and Nablus roundabout were targeted heavily by the Israeli airstrikes, and even the people there, and according to multiple international human rights organizations and the bodies, that the Israeli occupation forces are deliberately and systematically stalling and preventing the smooth delivery of those humanitarian aid to the needy people in a way that deepens and widens the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Condemnations are pouring in following the Israeli regime's attack on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, where dozens of Palestinians were killed or wounded. Iran's Prime Ministry spokesman said Israel's repeated attacks on hospitals are a blatant violation of international law and the most fundamental humanitarian principles. Nasser Kanani said over the last 6 months, Israel's long list of crimes against Palestinians, including occupation, assassination, violence, and hostage-taking, has grown to include genocide. Earlier, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said attacks on health centers will not give Israel any semblance of a victory. The outgoing Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtayyeh also slammed the international community for its inaction against Israel. The head of the World Health Organization described the attack as deeply concerning, warning of the risk to health workers, patients, and civilians. We've spoken to Tim Anderson, the director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Sydney. He argues that Israel wants to push the Palestinians in Gaza into full evacuation.
Really, Hamas is just the tip of the Palestinian resistance iceberg, and that's not going to go away anytime soon, basically. But when you're talking about Al-Shifa, remember also this is a hospital that was devastated before. It's in the north, in Gaza City. There are still civilians there, even though conditions of life have been very difficult in the areas. All of the residential areas been devastated around there. There also is resistance there. The resistance is back in areas where the Israelis thought they'd got rid of them. So the civilians are there. And really, of course, this idea that they're actually going after Hamas is only part of the story. Anyway, let's remember that they have said many times to us, you know, and this is what the South Africans have carried to the International Court of Justice. They want to destroy the conditions of life to make it unbearable. They want to destroy the people or drive them out. And of course, this new port that the US is involved in is widely suspected now of being a way to try and evacuate and take Palestinians out of Gaza to help with the ethnic cleansing of the area. So the assault on civilians has always been an openly stated part of this genocide. Very few genocides in the past have openly stated as clearly as the Israelis have this one.
France's ambassador and permanent representative to the UN has called on the Security Council to take action on the dire situation in Gaza.
So far, the Security Council has only been able to adopt two humanitarian resolutions, which, by the way, are not implemented. These councils need to do more, to do it now, and take up its responsibility. It cannot wait any longer. So this is why France requested close consultation on the situation in Gaza today. We want the members of this council to have a honest conversation on which measures can be taken by this council to stop this conflict. Well, we are supposed to take different steps. Now, the emergency is to do what I just said, an immediate ceasefire during Ramadan, release of hostages and full humanitarian access. So this is what the Security Council should do now, not next week. I'm talking about the next 24 or 48 hours. There is no reason to procrastinate further. No reason.
Riviere also described the humanitarian situation in the besieged Palestinian territory as absolutely catastrophic. He argued that this is not a natural disaster, but a war that should stop now, and that the Security Council cannot continue to procrastinate. France has been pushing for a ceasefire in Israel's war on Gaza. However, the 15-member UN body has failed to pass resolutions due to the constant U.S. vetoes. Over the past 5 months, since Israel launched its genocidal war on Gaza, Washington has vetoed 3 draft resolutions, 2 of which had demanded an immediate ceasefire. The EU foreign policy chief says Israel's genocide in Gaza has turned the territory into the world's biggest open-air graveyard.
The situation in Gaza. Gaza was before the war the greatest open-air prison. Today is the greatest open-air graveyard. A graveyard for tens of thousands of people, and also a graveyard for many of the most important principles of humanitarian law.
Borrell was speaking ahead of an EU foreign ministerial meeting in Brussels. He reiterated that Israel is using famine as a weapon of war by not allowing aid trucks into Gaza. Borrell said the issue is not a lack of sufficient supplies for Gaza, it's rather Israel deliberately preventing them from entering the besieged strip. According to the World Food Program, 70% of the remaining people in northern Gaza are at catastrophic levels of hunger.
We need sufficient amounts of food to get into northern Gaza and to be able to be distributed to the people who are in need over there. Mind you, there are 300,000 people in that location right now, of which 70%, meaning 210,000 people, are in catastrophic level of hunger. The remaining 30%, they are in emergency levels of hunger.
The UN-backed Food Security Assessment report also indicates that around half of the population of Gaza is experiencing catastrophic hunger due to the Israeli onslaught. Addressing the alarming new reports about hunger in Gaza, the UN Security General called for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire. The former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert has hailed the U.S. Senate Majority Leader for urging early Israeli elections to replace the regime's current premier, Benjamin Netanyahu. Olmert sent a letter to Chuck Schumer several days after the Democratic senator called Netanyahu a major obstacle to peace in Gaza. The former Israeli premier lauded Schumer for his courage to express how traditional supporters of Israel feel today. Olmert added that Netanyahu is unable to fulfill the responsibilities assigned to him. Schumer's call for the replacement of Netanyahu was also praised by Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid. He said that Netanyahu is losing Israel's biggest supporters. Schumer's remarks have signaled a widening rift between the Israeli regime and the U.S., a country that has been complicit in the Gaza genocide. The call for a snap election has angered Netanyahu, who responded by saying that Israel is not a banana republic. The Israeli military has carried out fresh raids across the occupied West Bank as the regime presses ahead with its offensive against Palestinians. In the latest such attacks, Israeli forces raided the town of Yamun, west of the city of Jenin, as well as a Palestinian refugee camp east of the city of Nablus. The regime forces abducted several people after storming Palestinian homes. Clashes also erupted between Israeli troops and resistance forces, which targeted soldiers and bulldozers with explosive devices. The Israeli military has intensified its violent raids across the West Bank since October 7, the day when the regime launched its genocidal war on Gaza. Hundreds of Palestinians have been killed and thousands abducted during Israeli incursions into the occupied towns and cities ever since. Our Ramallah correspondent Monica Ndil says Israeli troops have conducted new raids on several towns, villages, and refugee camps across the occupied West Bank.
This morning, the Israeli forces raided several areas across the occupied West Bank. Speaking from the south to the north of the occupied West Bank, raiding villages, towns, and refugee camps, the soldiers stormed a number of Palestinian homes and caused destruction inside the homes and the properties, and clashes, exchange of fire have taken place between the Israeli forces and members of the resistance groups. The Israeli forces raided Al-Jalazon refugee camp near Ramallah and arrested a Palestinian female journalist, Rola Hassanein. She's a mother and a wife, and she was arrested by the Israeli forces. It's not clear why she had been detained, but today we are speaking about 70 Palestinians were detained, 70 Palestinian journalists were detained by the Israeli forces since the 7th of October. At least over 35 of them are still being held by the Israeli forces. The Israeli troops also stormed Qalqilia and arrested at least three Palestinians there. The Israeli military had also carried out an operation in Nablus, mainly in the Balata refugee camp. And according to the Palestinian resistance, exchange of fire had taken place for several hours between the Israeli troops and the Palestinian fighters.
Israeli warplanes have carried out fresh airstrikes in Syria, targeting the Damascus countryside. According to the Syrian military, the missiles were launched from the direction of the occupied Golan Heights and targeted a number of military locations. Added that the country's air defenses intercepted and shot down some of the missiles. It noted that the burst only caused material damage. The Israeli regime frequently targets the war-ravaged Arab country, particularly areas in and around Damascus. The Syrian government has on numerous occasions called on the UN to force the Israeli regime to stop its acts of aggression. Damascus says the assaults are in violation of international law and aimed at propping up terrorists. Iran's ambassador to the UN has rejected as baseless U.S. and U.K. allegations that the Islamic Republic is supplying weapons and missiles to Yemen. In a letter to the president of the U.N. Security Council, Amir Said Iravani said the U.S. and the U.K. are using the allegations as a pretext to advance what he called their short-sighted political agenda. He said that London and Washington also want to justify their military aggression against Yemen, which they allegedly launched in response to the country's anti-Israeli operations in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. Iravani condemned the military aggression as a violation of Yemen's sovereignty and territorial integrity, as well as international law. He said attacks also pose a serious threat to regional peace and stability. Iravani stressed that Iran consistently advocates for the peaceful resolution of the Yemen crisis through diplomatic channels. Iran is marking the 73rd anniversary of the nationalization of its oil industry. That was a turning point in the political and economic history of the Iranian nation to save the national treasure from foreigners. Fatemeh Masoumi has the details.
20th, 1951, members of the Iranian parliament passed a bill introduced by the country's democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, to nationalize Iran's oil industry. The groundbreaking initiative put an end to Britain's four-decade dominion over Iran's oil industry. The Britain-owned Anglo-Iranian oil company enjoyed a monopolistic control over the industry and paid only a meager portion of the revenues to the Iranian government.
Nationalization was a call for independence. If you go back then, the Iranians, the entire public, realized that this move was not about economy. It was about independence. And ergo, the Mossadegh movement was very popular within, and the entire world realized that it was about gaining independence from a colonial power that controlled the economy and based on the economy, controlled the political spectrum within Iran.
When the then government of Mossadegh put the nationalizing of Iran's oil on its agenda in April 1951, acts of sabotage and conspiracy against the country were enhanced. The American-British coup in August 1953 against Mossadegh's government was part of the plot.
Basically, the British were plundering Iranian natural resources, and oil was at the top of the list. Iranians began to protest, and there was a growing social movement in the country to nationalize Iranian oil. When that ultimately happened, the British imposed sanctions on the country, similar to what happened after the revolution in Iran.
After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran achieved significant milestones in the petroleum industry. These include the discovery of numerous oil and gas fields, an expansion in extractable oil and condensate reserves, a rise in oil production and extractable gas, and the discovery of new oil and gas fields. Iran was the first country in the West Asia to reclaim its oil industry. The Iranian nation's move proved to be of great importance in giving rise to the anti-colonialist tendencies all over the region and set a trend for other countries. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Cuba has summoned the top U.S. diplomat on the island to protest against Washington, provoking unrest in the country. Havana says the U.S. is seeking to turn local protests into a broader anti-government uprising. Islam is interventionist and slanderous. U.S. Embassy calls on the Cuban government to respect the human rights of the protesters. Washington has denied that allegation. Protests against power cuts and food shortages have broken out into a number of Cuban cities, including the second largest city of Santiago. The Cuban government says the protests were, quote, respectful. Since 1960, the U.S. has maintained an economic embargo and other sanctions against Cuba. And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales, roundtable discussions, culture, politics, all produced by IRIB English Radio.
The limelight. Tel Aviv is coming up against myriad obstacles, from the loss of Western public opinion to the nervousness of its key backers. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, "For 75 years, the Western world was indifferent. But this war is forcing the Zionist regime's Western backers to see the full horrors of the crimes being committed in a campaign they described 5 months ago as just. Even a progressive critic of the Zionist regime like U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders said 5 months ago that the war against resistance group Hamas was just. The degree of brutality and glee shown by the Zionist regime troops as they go on their daily killing sprees, starving Gaza and then dropping leaflets in Arabic telling Palestinians to feed the needy, killing 400 people waiting for aid and then vowing to flood Gaza with aid, all of this is too much to sweep under the carpet when this war stops. A Rubicon has been crossed. With this war, the Zionist regime has entered the elite rank of pariah states. It is now the ugliest of the ugly. It's impossible to forgive. It cannot be justified, nor can it be put into context. The entire operation in Gaza is an atrocity. Liberal Zionism has become a contradiction in terms. It's too much of a straight. Acting like this, the Zionist regime has become not the home of a beleaguered people persecuted around the world for millennia, but the Fort Knox of Jewish supremacism, the natural heir to white supremacists. This is having a transformational effect on Jewish people worldwide, in whose name and common past these crimes are being committed." The short cri du coeur of Jonathan Glazer, the British director of the Zone of Interest, did not come out of the blue when he said during his Oscar acceptance speech, "We stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people." The same cry of "not in my name" is coming from the thousands of young Jews who are marching every weekend in London to stop the war in Gaza. Emily, a Jewish activist with the group Na'mud UK, recently said, "I think there has been a quiet reckoning in our community, and you can see this because the bloc keeps growing. The movement keeps growing. The constituency organizations keep getting bigger and bigger. I have never been so sure that I will see a free Palestine." Asked what she thought of her government's attempts to brand these marches as the work of extremists, she said, "I'm very tired of being told how to feel as a Jewish person by people who are not Jewish. I'm tired of being told to feel afraid when these marches are, by and large, peaceful. And people are so lovely to us and so thankful to us. It really shows the ignorance of Jewish opinion outside of their very small Zionist rabble." This is where real leadership is coming from. It's on the streets, not parliament. These are the lions. The political leaders are the donkeys, she said. The Zionist regime and its apologists are right to be scared of what a new generation of American and British Jews are telling them. For the last 8 decades, the child killer regime of Israel governed a consensus about its existence, identity, and purpose that was more powerful than all the arms, money, and Jewish migrants it received. The weaker this consensus becomes, the quicker the Zionist regime will lose its influence in the centers of Western powers. Already, the compulsive addiction of support for the Zionist regime is upending the West's own attempts to explain to itself that it is a moral force, a force for good in the world. Under the British government's latest definition of extremism, it is right to support a government that flouts the Genocide Convention, starves a population under occupation, and kills unarmed mothers and children at will, but extremists to protest against that on the streets of London. This is a patent absurdity. It is left to the likes of South Africa to show Britain the way. It is now going to prosecute its citizens who return after fighting for the Zionist regime's army. It will take time to erode, but after what has happened in Gaza, the future will surely not guarantee the hold the Zionist regime has over every major Western political party. It will not be able to dictate the definition of anti-Semitism, nor will it guarantee the funds that aspiring Western politicians need. Today, every Tory and Labour politician with ambitions for the top job must, almost by definition, be a friend of Israel, a club that maintains a stronghold on each parliamentary party. That might not be true for the next generation of politicians. Jewish academic opposition to the fabricated regime of Israel is strong and vocal. It cannot accurately be called fringe. The child killer regime of Israel is now starting to lose the global Jewish voice.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the U.S.-Israeli Holocaust on Palestinians in Gaza has reached its 164th day. The regime continues to up the ante in trying to see how much more misery it can cause the Palestinians. Besides the sniping and bombing of people and structures, starvation is another weapon of choice by the Zionists that is increasingly claiming more victims. Newborns are the first to succumb to starvation, and then other infants and kids. The world is watching the systematic genocide of Gazans as more political leaders give some verbal condemnation but take no action. This while Palestinian kids ask, why is it a crime to be Palestinian in this world? But I'd like to welcome my guests to this program. Amal Wahdan, human rights activist out of Ramallah. And Ali Salam, editor-in-chief of Basir Press out of Tehran. Well, thank you both for being with me. I'm going to start this off in Ramallah and Amman. The regime can kill tens of thousands of people in real time. It can destroy all infrastructure. It can prevent food and supplies from entering Gaza and starve the population to death. Now, the regime can kill patients in hospitals and destroy those structures. Are there any red lines for the regime on what it cannot do against Palestinians?
Actually, it's not only this regime that is waging this war against the Palestinians. If it was only this regime, that would be a different story. But this regime is backed up by the U.S., regardless of the U.S. Rhetoric about, human devastations and crises and all of, public statements that Biden comes up with or his spokesperson. If this regime wasn't backed by the U.S. in particular and the rest of the Western world, it wouldn't last, because we've seen that we're entering the 6th month and the regime is torn apart when we are talking about military performance, security, economic, all of this actually is affecting the Israelis. And we daily read reports by Israeli strategists about the endless war, about a no strategy war. So all that means that this regime is not carrying this war by itself. The U.S. is complicit in it, and the rest of the Western world. Unfortunately, the Arab and Islamic world has done almost zero in terms of this crisis. If we put aside the axis of resistance, of course, and some of the Islamic countries, but the majority of the Arab countries, especially the Gulf countries, the rest of the Islamic world hasn't budged much to come forward to put an end to this crisis. I think it is actually tied up with more, let's say, geopolitical strategy run by the U.S.
Okay, we'll get back to you on that. Interesting point that you're making. Well, Ali, when we look at the situation that is happening, as we just heard, almost 6 months in the making now, is there any way possible this type of carnage would have been allowed to take place against Europeans?
Absolutely not. As we can see, the world reaction to something like the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, which came as a result of 8 years of shelling constantly on an almost daily basis of the various cities and regions in the Donbas area, Lugansk and Donetsk. And the moment Russia decides to defend these people who are majority ethnic and ethnic speaking Russians, they come in and look what happened. They became the most sanctioned country in the world, even to the point of surpassing Iran in number of sanctions. The media vilified them, and then to the point of even erasing Russian culture, like Dostoevsky or Tchaikovsky or all these other significant figures in Russian culture and arts. None of this has been done to the Zionist regime, there is not really an existent Israeli culture. Hummus is not Israeli. These types of things are not Israeli. So they don't really have so much of a culture that we can blockade from the minds of the people. But exposing the truth about Zionism and its global network and various different spheres of the world gets you banned off of Twitter, gets you banned off of Facebook, gets you banned off of Meta. Those are the same thing. And the mainstream media is, you know, not talking about this. It just goes to show who is in control of the major centers of power in the world. And it's these who are having the blood of all these people directly on their hands. These are the criminals. But because they control the media, they can flip the script and they can ignore their own crimes and be able to cover up their own crimes as a kind of as a hand in hand with the military crimes is the media to help cover up their complicity.
Okay. Well, Aman, who's responsible to prevent starvation from being used as a weapon of war? We seem to have quite a dilemma because on the one hand, you alluded to the Western hegemonic front actually being responsible for this in general. And then on the other hand, that same Western hegemonic front is the front that is actually supposed to be controlling or helping enforce international law. So answer that question. I mean, who's supposed to be responsible for this? Who's supposed to be preventing this from happening?
Actually, in the current world that we are living in, the UN should be the first or international organization to put an end to this. But who's controlling the UN? as we have seen, as we have witnessed through the three past decades, all these wars that the Middle East was subjected to by the USA and the Western, its Western allies, the UN did not do anything. And as for the Palestinians in Gaza, the UN and UNRWA should be responsible in, you know, work and relief agency. The UNRWA is for the work and relief for the Palestinians, but it cannot do its work. Actually, it has been prevented from doing its work. Its employees have been targeted. We lost a number, dozens of employees of the UNRWA. And at the end, the Israelis were pointing fingers at criminalize some of the employees of the UNRWA. So the international organizations cannot do much for us. And the Western world, you have seen the double standard when it comes to Ukraine. They acted in a different way. But when it comes to the Palestinians, when it comes to the Israeli regime, they act in a different way. From one hand, they want also to protect their military base here, their stronghold in this area. And from the other hand, there is, as I was trying to say, there is a strategy behind all this. And we've seen what happened during the 12 years of what they called the Arab Spring in different parts of the Middle East, different Arab countries. And all of that was because of the gas. They wanted to establish a route for natural gas parallel to that of Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2. And now I think it's the same thing happening again. Remember that they have started this route from United Arab Emirates through the Saudi Arabia, Jordan, to help the Israelis, because the Israelis has been suffering. They don't have any exports. They don't have any, the settlements are is not providing products for the Israeli economy. So the economy is paralyzed at the moment. But hey, where United Arab Emirates jumped in there and opened a route to help the Israelis. But this route now is planned to get a parallel route to the gas, the Russian gas, the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2, and to encounter the Belt and the Road initiative, the Chinese Belt and the Road, which achieved a lot during the past 15 years. So we are encountering now another hegemonic attack by the U.S. to seize the natural gas off the shores of Gaza. The Itamar field, gas field, which is controlled by the Israelis, belongs to the Gaza Strip, belongs to the Palestinians. Now they want a route comes from India through United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, up to the Mediterranean.
Okay.
Now this brings the global, you know, the global powers into a new confrontation. I think President Putin mentioned that we are about to enter World War III if the Western world continues to provide Ukraine with weapons. Now, he's going to, I mean, maybe they come short of explaining the other threat for World War III, which is the current American hegemony. They are trying to build a floating pier on the coastline of Gaza shores. That means the Americans are trying to occupy directly.
Okay.
I'm not saying indirectly. They are trying to occupy Gaza and at the same time protecting the Israeli regime from collapsing.
Well, okay, let me get Ali back in on this. Ali, you heard what Amal is saying. One, talking about the Western hegemonic front, also then talking about various Muslim countries or Arab countries working along, it appears, with these Western hegemonic entities. Your take on that, and if it's so, why is that the case? What are these Arab regimes trying to get when their Arab brethren, their Muslim brothers, are being slaughtered in front of their eyes?
These regimes are only outwardly Muslim, but every human being is designed to worship. Worship what? That's up to the human being. These people, they worship money, they worship wealth and material. You see the way they live, and they live all these lavish lifestyles. Honestly, it puts their economies as a house of cards, especially during the coronavirus when there was a simultaneous oil price war that drove the price of oil down. Their economies took a big hit because they live in this fantasy world, and I think that all importing material goods, Ferraris and everything like that, they're only interested in money and power. They don't care about other Muslims because the Muslim is just a name for them. They don't care about their other Arab brethren because to them they think that they're above the rest of humanity, and there's a doubt if about the nature of their ethnicity among some academic circles. But they're not going to care because they're only interested in maintaining their power. And that's why some may have pivoted towards Iran, for example, because they feel that the U.S. will get rid of them if they get a little bit too ahead of themselves, like as what the U.S. did to Saddam, for example. And they have been actually trying to do to Mohammed bin Salman because they see him as too ambitious, and that his stunts can potentially destabilize the Saudi regime, and they would replace him with somebody that's potentially more of a stabilizer than him. But they're all complicit in normalizing with the Zionist regime, and they don't care about the Palestinians at all. So this is just part of the game that they're playing, and they're going to essentially coronate it through an establishment of another puppet regime in Palestine. And all the maneuvers that we've been seeing with the Palestinian Authority, with President Biden and Senator Chuck Schumer saying that Netanyahu needs to go, and many statements against the resistance by some comprador classes within the Palestinian political blocs. They're all essentially preparing to create a comprador regime to govern over all of Palestine, including Gaza, to basically snuff out the resistance and get rid of the last remaining form of independent government that exists among the Palestinians, which is the Hamas government.
Okay.
And replace it with something similar to the Zionist-controlled Palestinian Authority. And the Gulf states will be the rubber stamp for this because they'll promise all the money and the aid and the reconstruction as long as Palestinians are humiliated just like they are humiliated and follow the same agenda of being essentially second-class puppets of the Zionists and the Americans.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Amal, Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest medical facility in Gaza, was hit again by the Israeli regime on Sunday. It's the fourth time the facility has been targeted. There are thousands of people taking shelter in the hospital complex. Now, more Palestinians, of course, were killed yesterday and wounded who were taking refuge inside of the complex. Your thoughts on why the Israeli regime, the U.S.-backed Israeli regime, continues to attack and destroy hospitals and kidnap hospital staff? I mean, what is their goal specifically in dealing with medical facilities in the way they are?
you know, when they are committing mass genocide against the Palestinians, targeting, you know, airstrikes, bombardment from the sea and land tanks, they are using every method of lethal weapon to exterminate the Palestinians. And the hospitals for them were targeted from, you know, the first week of the ground invasion. They don't want to leave any facility, any health facility that can provide health services, that can, you know, rescue the wounded from being from dying. So the facility, the hospitals and the health facilities for them is another target, another lethal weapon that they can use to exterminate the Palestinians. I mean, all what we are seeing on TV screens is, you know, it's a show of a continuous, deliberate killing. I can't describe it in more specific words, except they have surpassed the Nazis during World War II. And when we see the children and the women, the helpless children and women under the rubble and, you know, even the cemeteries, they were excavating the cemeteries. I mean, all kinds, all sorts of crimes, especially the hospitals, as we've been seeing, saying. So, these institutions, whether it's the health, whether it's the education, whether it's you know, the churches, the mosques, the buildings, 80% of Gaza has been demolished, has been destructed under the eyes of the whole world. And I have to say, if we don't have the axis of resistance, it would be really hard for the Palestinian resistance to continue this fight. And thanks God that we have the resistance in South Lebanon, in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, and of course the Islamic Republic of Iran. And other than that, I'm afraid that even Russia and China are only playing a diplomatic role rather than play, you know, exerting more pressure on the U.S.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure that they have other, you know, weak points that they can pressure the U.S. At least to ease in, at least to accept a ceasefire. The Americans do not accept a long-term ceasefire. They only asking for short-term ceasefire. So, from this, you can, you know, come to a conclusion that the U.S. really wants Gaza to be unlivable place, and the Israelis already have put plans to reoccupy Gaza. And to add to is the floating pier on the coastline. That's what they are trying to do, to reoccupy Gaza. But I don't think they will succeed, because the Israelis are facing internal problems that prevent them from reaching the victory that they are seeking to.
Well, Eileen, EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell says Israel's genocide in Gaza has now turned the territory into the world's biggest open-air graveyard, whereas before it was the world's biggest open-air prison. Your thoughts on his comments? Because representing the EU, one would think that if he felt like that before, that perhaps he should have done something when it was the world's biggest open-air prison, but we didn't see any action coming from the EU. Your thoughts?
We didn't see any action then, and we're not going to see any action now. These statements are empty, and they're an insult to the ocean of blood that has been spilled, which has been assisted by EU member states. In fact, most of them are assisting in this genocide one way or another. Italy, France, England, although I believe England exited the EU, but is still an ally nonetheless. This is just the nature of the EU and the UN is just to issue toothless statements that don't mean anything. As His Eminence Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, said many years ago, that the UN and these types of international organizations will condemn both the killer and the victim. So we should also look at their statements about the resistance. And as I mentioned before, the slanderous statements against the resistance by certain comprador factions among Palestinian political blocs are essentially blaming the resistance for the genocide of Gaza, as if Israel hasn't been doing these types of measures beforehand and wouldn't have done these types of things maybe over a longer period of time, but would have done them anyways. Their goal was to eventually get rid of Gaza entirely, and they would have done it without any pretext. And they had attacked Gaza long before Hamas even existed in 2005 or established the government in 2006.
All right, let me get Ahmad back in on this because I want to look at the geopolitical significance of all this that Ahmad, you had alluded to earlier. Let's talk about what we're seeing in Gaza and the moves by which entities, which parties, and what does it mean in your perspective from a geopolitical level?
Sorry, I didn't get that.
I want the geopolitical significance you had alluded to earlier about what is happening in Gaza. Your take on that, please.
Right. But before this, 7 October, I think it was a preemptive action by the resistance, by the Palestinian resistance, and by Al-Qassam brigades in particular, because the Israelis were planning this. And if you remember, Netanyahu, in his way of, being a comedian, he was showing a map in his speech in front of the UN General Assembly, and he was showing a map with an alternative route starts from India across United Arab Emirates. And, hey, United Arab Emirates in all, conspiracies here, and its presence is unprecedented by any other country, as if it was planned to play this role. So it starts from India to United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and then through it was meant to be the Israeli port, but now it's coming from Gaza to Cyprus, to Europe. And this plan was meant to encounter the Nord Stream 1 and Nord Stream 2, the Russian gas. And that's why I think President Putin has warned against a possible of eruption of World War III. Well, based on what's happening on Ukraine, and now to add to it what's going on in Gaza and the scale of the attack, of the aggression, is also unprecedented. It's like World War III that we are living in Gaza area in at 365 square kilometers, and with 2.3 million people being squeezed in, sieged, blockaded for 17 years, and now exterminated. So this whole thing makes a sense that the geopolitical strategy for the U.S.
All right.
And
on that note, so sorry to interrupt you, Ahmad, but we are out of time. I appreciate both of you being with me, Ahmad Wahdan, human rights activist out of Ramallah, and Ali Salam, editor-in-chief, Basira Press out of Tehran. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi signing out for myself and all the group right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah who is الرحمن. Allah who is المنان. لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom and Islamic scholar, Shaykh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
All right, Shaykh Rouhani, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the establishment of a government at the time of the reappearance of Imam al-Mahdi Jalallah. How long is it? Is it all-encompassing? I mean, Imam is going to rule over all the people around the world, on what religions and what minorities, race or language. So let's be concerned with the first part of the question, that is Imam As going to establish a kind of government or authority at the time of his reappearance or not?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, of course. You know, here, whatever I can say is from the riwayat and ahadith narrated from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam by Sunni and Shia scholars and narrators, or some of the riwayat which are narrated from only the Shiite sources from the Aimma alayhi salatu wassalam. Yeah, the establishment of hukuma and government and ruling over the people is something for sure and certain, that of course Imam will establish the final or the ultimate version of divine hukuma and political system to govern, to rule over the all nations across the globe. This is what is mentioned in riwayat, and it is for sure for Muslims. Did you ask also about the timing of these?
The second part is about the length of these type of government or establishment.
Yeah, again, about the quality or the characteristics of this government or system that Imam will establish, we cannot clearly say every details about that. But some of the things that are mentioned in the riwayat and ahadith,